Hello, ladies and gentlemen. I welcome you to the Terrorism Analysis Platform, also known as TAP. You are listening to our latest podcast of our new podcast series where we analyze terrorist groups, strategies, and events. I'm your host, Mehmet Devrim, a research assistant at the SETA Foundation Ankara. This series will bring you four experts on terrorism in the African continent. We have divided the series into three episodes: Terrorism in the Sahel region, Financing Terrorism in Africa, and finally, an episode on the two largest terrorist organizations in Africa, Al-Shabaab and Boko Haram. Our first episode is on terrorism in the Sahel region. Our expert on this issue is Mr. Isidore Aga from Uludag University. Welcome, Mr. Aga. Could you please introduce yourself to our audiences so they know you as well?
Thank you very much, Mehmet, for this opportunity. I am Isidore Aga. Currently working on issues of terrorism, counter-terrorism, as well as peace building and development in Africa.
Mr. Aga, to get straight into the topic, a lot of countries in the world have repeatedly experienced coup d'etats from their militaries. And the countries in the African continent and the Sahel region are no exception to this. Indeed, in some of those countries, one might argue that it is the norm. How should the impact of repeated coup d'etats on the Sahel axis be analyzed from a regional security perspective?
I think that the issue of terrorism and security within Africa is a very perennial issue, and Sahel itself is a very critical case, because in recent times we've seen a plethora of coup d'etats that have taken place in some kind of a domino effect. If we can say that, which is, of course, it's worrying, and it calls both for policy as well as for academic evaluation of the situation. But however, you know, the insurgencies in Sahel, from a security perspective, we have to begin by understanding that the insurgencies reveal the fragility of the states. That's one of the things we must understand, that it reveals the fragility of these states and their inability to provide adequate protection and security for their citizens, which in some ways the military has capitalized on this vacuum as long as jihadism and terrorism remains prevalent across the region. So there's been a tendency for the military to use this justification for acquiring and seizing power under the guise of, you know, being guardians of the state, in promising democracy that will never come. So what I would like to describe as stagnant democracies, because these transitions never seem to end. However, looking from a security perspective and analyzing the situation is very critical, because if you look at the security complex within the Sahel region, it's the situation of the security complex is getting critical as much as the crisis situation, because right now it is very difficult for the situation to be arrested, the terrorism situation to be arrested within the Sahel region, because if you look at it, one of the key points is that the African Union and ECOWAS do not really have some kind of a strong physical security presence in that area. And then now the sub-regional security complex like the G5 Sahel, very recently with the ascension of power of Assimi Goïta, it was discovered that the transitional government in Mali has withdrew itself from the G5 Sahel security architecture, which greatly in some way hampers the security potential of that security complex to be able to effectively address the situation within the region. Because if we may understand, in contemporary times and in recent times, the domino effect of coup d'etats in the Sahel region started with the 2012 coup in Mali. And so in contemporary times, we've seen the ripple effect and the spillover effect of that coup into Burkina Faso, Niger, Chad, Guinea, and other countries in that region. So if you look at that from that perspective, Mali's absence from that security architecture is a major loophole, which is definitely deepening the security situation and the terrorism situation in it. Another issue, if from the security perspective, is we're looking at the critical situation of France's recent departure, from Mali. But France has said it's going to continue its security architecture within the Sahel, but not with Mali, because of its ruptured relationship with Mali. And Mali has gone forth to bring in the Wagner group from Russia to able to fill in the security gap or assistance that France was protecting for that place. And following suit, we understand that that has definitely reduced in some way the capacity of Operation Barkhane, which was an operation that was essentially meant for the Sahel region. Yeah, many have criticized the effectiveness of Barkhane, but in some way it cannot be totally, shelved or overridden and say there was no effectiveness in it. So I think that it has its loopholes, it has its inadequacies, but definitely Operation Barkhane was effective in some ways in countering terrorism in that. And following suit with France's departure, we discovered that the EU also, the EU, the Takuba Task Force also cut down its connection with Mali because of France's departure. And in all that, so when there is definitely some kind of a security lacuna in the Sahel that further deepens the security situation in that part of Africa, definitely. So the conflict is expanding, as it's becoming more and more complicated with more entrepreneurs of violence with different, varying backgrounds that are coming into the conflict to take a part and take participation. So, and also we also discovered that the security situation in Mali, as you know, in Sahel, has weakened regional cooperation. It has military coups have weakened the regional cooperation in the fight against terrorism, because each and every country now is divided in its effort to protect and to preserve its territorial integrity and sovereignty. And so that limits the appetite and the potential to extend their efforts or resources towards, regional cooperation in the fight against terrorism. And so if we look at it from that place, from that point of view, there is a lot of that is going on. And right now, there is now the issue of geopolitics that has come in. We have a divided army in most of these countries. The army that was supposed to be the backbone to provide security for the state and preserve the integrity of the state for democracy and development to thrive is at the center of instability, because it has been a principal actor in all of this. So with a divided army and with Russia and French having a debacle over Mali and all that, at the end of the day, the winners in all this instability, it's not the Russians or the French or the Malian people, but groups like Al-Qaeda and Daesh and Boko Haram and other and their affiliates.
Mr. Aga, thank you very much for the response. In your response, you have already touched upon the topic of my next question. So let's consider this an opportunity to further elaborate on that topic. As coup d'etats have both domestic and security policy reasons, is there a connection between coup d'etats in Mali, Niger, Burkina Faso, and Chad, and terrorism, or are the coups we have experienced a result of domestic politics in those countries?
I think that principally there is a connection between these coups, and even though we want to establish a connection between these coups, one must also be careful to understand that these coups have their peculiarities, because the coup d'etat in Mali, Niger, Burkina Faso, and Chad, occur or happen within fixed geopolitical spaces that have their own peculiarities, and the way the political setup in Mali is just played out and the dynamics that go on in Mali are not the same dynamics, that occurred in Chad or in the case in Burkina Faso. But however, when in establishing this connection, the connection that one must establish is the fact that there is a kind of a flare of military takeover becoming some kind of a fashionable way of governance within the Sahel region. So because it succeeded with Assimi Goïta and in Mali, it become fashionable for Burkina Faso to pick up the trend. So in Chad and pick up the trend, and Niger picking up the trend. And so we've seen this go down. And one of the things that we must keep in mind is the fact that the historical background, the history of these countries is rooted in coup d'etats. So they have a history of coup d'etats, you know. They have a history of coup d'etats that keep them connected, and that lies in their history and in the development of the governance of the state as some kind of I'll put it quote unquote the devil in the detail. You know, that history is some kind of the devil in the detail that always erupted. And so the situation in Mali caused a domino effect that cannot lead us to connect what is going on in these other countries. And however, there are domestic issues, you know, that are plaguing the countries, that are plaguing the countries. Definitely, I'm sure we'll touch on that as we progress through the interview.
If possible, I would like to take you up on that offer. Why wait to talk about those issues later in the interview when we can do it now? Terrorists and terrorism cannot live without a ground to nurture the extremist ideology on. And as you mentioned, the domestic and specifically the social situation does usually influence its relationship with terrorist organizations. To what degree do you think the ethnic and social issues plaguing countries on the Sahel axis work in favor of terrorist organizations in the region?
I think this is the issue of ethnicity and conflict in Africa is a deep-rooted issue, you know, that can hardly be separated, because if you look at example from the situation in Mali, the reason why the northern Mali, the beginning of the conflict by the Tuaregs, you know, in the days past was because, and the National Movement for the Liberation of Azawad, was because they thought Mali was principally a northern, predominantly Muslim area that had been neglected by the southern dominated governments. And so that religiosity and ethnicity are key factors that determine governance and policy in Africa, and especially when we're talking about conflict, instability, and terrorism. And so this ethnic, when there is the sense of discrimination or neglect, you know, or underdevelopment in one part of the country, when they begin to feel aggrieved, then definitely that's what we can start talking about aggression, you know, frustration, aggression theory. That when frustration sets in, it gives the ground for aggression to rise. And so when one ethnic group feel that, oh, these particular people are the ones that have been in power for this long, it becomes a cause for them to start agitating and for them to start, you know, being easy recruits into terrorist organizations. And so the promises that these terrorist organizations offer them is some kind worldwide that gives them the urge to find succor, or to think that this is a route for them to redress the inequality and the deprivation that they have experienced so far. But however, one must also look at some of the kinds of the structural issues that shape this society. For example, within the Sahel region, there is the issue of environmental stress. You know, Sahel is an arid region that has constantly faced conditions of drought, desertification, and variations in rainfall, climate change, you know, and this is come with the accompanying effects of things like food security issues and livelihoods issues. And so cumulatively put together, these are things that affect the stability of the state. And so these are social issues that come to play and to able to give voice for intercommunal violence and rivalry, irredentism, and political instability. You know, and also, like I indicated before, we discovered that rooted in the background of these countries, you know, is the issue of historical grievances that come up, whether they be social or they be ethnic or they be religious or whatever perspective. There are historical grievances, of course, in these countries, in Mali, Burkina Faso, Niger, Chad, they have varying degrees. However, this has complicated intergroup relations and political dynamics, you know, and state building processes across the Sahel country. So the inability of the state to adequately respond to these grievances exacerbate the problems which have escalated and manifested in the spread of terrorism, criminality, jihadism in the Sahel, We also have, if you may permit me to go on, issues of fractured state processes, forging a common national identity in the Sahelian states and a collective destiny among its people within has been a deep-seated challenge, which has definitely been a culture because once the people cannot identify with and to the state, they become alienated from the state structures. And so when they become alienated from the state structures, it gives them the urge and ability to challenge the integrity of the state. There is also the issue of migration. There's also the issue of migration across the Sahelian countries, which goes beyond climate conditions. So the flow of refugees, moving of livestock in from war affected areas, adds to the insecurity situation. We already touched about food situation. We have one of the key things that I want to highlight here, Mehmet, is the fact that there is the kind of politicized military coups, politicized military coups and mutinies, overt or covert intention, have a regular occurrence in the front lines of countries. So overall, the exclusionary policies and the political repression associated with politicized security, establishment is an important trigger for instability and other insecurities in the Sahel. So we have the rise of jihadi and criminal networks. Jihadi and criminal networks have principally find a safe haven in Sahel because of the politicized military coups that have been taking place in that region. So conflict and insecurities and the perpetrators have transmitted the grievance from these areas to be able to find some kind of safe haven or some kind of an alliance with this transnational criminal networks like Boko Haram, Daesh, ISIL, Akim, and so on, to be able to foster the problems of insecurity in these countries. So we must never not, we must also not forget the fact that there is corruption and general socioeconomic deprivation, within these countries, that all of these Sahelian countries are targeted and endowed with some kind of natural resources. However, the paradox is that they are plagued with governance challenges because, as such, there's no effective management of the a youth public population that is growing on. And in the midst of corruption and socioeconomic deprivation, with a rising population of its useful population, these youths become easy recruits into this transnational terrorist networks because, one, there are no opportunities, for them to thrive economically, no jobs for them, to hang on. So when these youths become idle, they become easy recruits for transnational terrorist organizations who promise them all kinds of benefits and promise them some kind of pseudo-heroism as redeemers of their communities or to reverse the difficulties and the challenges that they are facing. So a plethora of these social factors and its ethnic flavor put together all culminate into creating this atmosphere of instability within the region of Sahel.
Thank you very much for that response, Mr. Aga. For our last question, we want to discuss counterterrorism operations. Counterterrorism operations have all kinds of shapes and forms. They can be non-repressive and focus on de-radicalization, or they can be more hard power focused. What kind of security operations are required in the Sahel region to stop and prevent the activities of Daesh and Al-Qaeda linked terrorist organizations?
I think that in answering this question, there is a unilateral approach to counterterrorism. It's never sustainable. Whether it has to do with counterterrorism or it has to do with issues of peacekeeping, peace building, a unilateral approach is never sustainable. So if we rely on non-repressive measures alone, we are not going to achieve the objective, because these groups by themselves, they are very, the jihadist groups like Daesh, Al-Qaeda, Boko, they are rootless. They are rootless. And so it will take a measure of also hardline security to be able to pursue this group. But however, beginning from like the non-repressive Focus on de-radicalization or non-repressive means. So one of the things that we can begin with is the fact that a political strategy, you know, first of all, for counter-terrorism missions must encompass the projects to provide services and better governance, you know, in areas where non-state groups have gained influence. So that's one of the first things that have to do to provide, to make sure that there's governance and then there is the presence of government infrastructure, government services in that area, you know, where armed states have gained influence. Because when the people begin to feel the presence of the government, then the dominance of the armed state, of the non-state actors will begin to eventually wither away. Another thing that we must take into cognizance is the fact that stakeholders must contemplate on dialoguing, engaging into dialogue with non-state armed groups as a non-repressive, you know, method of de-radicalization. They must engage with non-state armed groups, and which is sometimes it is seen as a taboo for many state governments, you know, because they see it as coming down to negotiate to resolve. But it is critical as a non-repressive means, you know, to resolve both the humanitarian and political crisis situations in this country. And equally, the governments in the Sahel need to seek dialogue with these armed groups effectively, you know, that could encourage, for instance, local ceasefire accords, you know, that can ease the suffering in the rural areas, you know, open up space for return of services or return of refugees, and allow residents, you know, to return to their homes and rebuild their livelihoods, you know. And equally, countering this international terrorism requires effective multilateral, you know, responses, you know, that address current and convergent threats, such as worsening of climate crisis, armed conflict. There is the issue of poverty. There is the issues of inequality, lawless cyberspace, and even the uneven recovery from COVID-19 is still hitting Africa and the Sahel very hard. So we must be able, as a matter of fact, to be able to engage these non-repressive measures. However, like I indicated before, the robust military approach to countering insurgents and terrorist groups, it cannot totally be, you know, be eliminated from the counter-terrorism framework. So from where I stand and in my understanding, though there is a military security approach, it's of essence, the non-repressive measures together with the non-military approach, it's very critical in addressing these situations. But however, this is not a one-size-fits-all. Every country within the Sahel region must able to critically look at their governance and security policy and particular circumstances, and go back to why the conflict or the terrorism was triggered or found expression in the first place. What are the key foundational reasons why conflict or this terrorism activities began in the first place? To look at those reasons and then adapt these non-repressive responses to address those situations from the grassroots, you know, before coming at the national level. So on the whole, Mehmet, I want to say that we must strike a better balance and ensure that there is coherence and complementarity between preventive and militarized responses.